Amen.
Wow, full house. How are y'all? Good morning. I'm Brian, if I haven't gotten a chance to meet every one of you. Hey, first of all, if you could do me a favor, if you're seated with gaps between you, and this is our favorite part of the day, we're going to do the booty shuffle and scooch in this way. Still, we're at the place where you can have one seat per person. We haven't changed that rule yet, but if you don't scooch, we will. But we have some people in the back that are wanting to find seats. So I'm Brian, and I'm really excited to get to be here with y'all and get to share a little bit. A few weeks ago, I don't know if y'all were here, Labor Day weekend, Keyes shared. And one of the things that he said was that it's funny that he feels like he always gets asked by Buddy to speak on Labor Day because it's also the smallest crowd of the year. Well, this was our first Gwinnett County fall festival. I don't know what you call this break, four-day holiday. And so I am competing with Keyes for the smallest day of the year. And so I think Buddy knows what he's doing, having me here. But I appreciate y'all being here and not going on vacation or coming back from vacation. But where we're going today, if you don't have a Bible, we have some Bible carts and some Bible cart drivers somewhere. That if you need a Bible, just throw up your hand. Or if you need a blue sheet, make sure you get one of those. That you're going to want a Bible, you can go on and open up to 1 Corinthians 13. That's where we're diving into today. If you get one of those blue Bibles, it's actually on page 691, if that helps you out. And if you don't have a Bible of your own, then take this blue Bible home with you. It's our gift to you. We really do believe that what's contained in that book has the power to change your life forever. So, if you don't have a Bible, then take that with you. But 1 Corinthians 13 is where we are. The other thing about Keyes when he shared, when he was speaking, does anybody remember what his topic was? It's just one word. Joy, yeah. And so he kind of gave this talk on joy, that joy should be a mark of a believer, of a follower of Jesus, and how we should practice this discipline of joy. And there's actually a story, a backstory to that sermon, some things that we've kind of wrestled through that he didn't have time to share. So I'm actually just going to share it for him. And but that was a few years ago. There was a group of us that we kind of got together and met for accountability. And we would just get together as about five guys, and we get together every Tuesday morning and just talk. And we realized at this one point as we gathered that, you know, we were all kind of new in ministry, you know, newly married, started having kids in this whole process. And so there's a lot going on. And so we just get together and just spend that time together. And, you know, how are you doing? What's going on in your life? Well, one time, one Tuesday morning, we got together and we realized that we had just spent the last hour and a half complaining to each other, basically. I mean, just, you know, well, this isn't going right and this, and I have to deal with this, and can you believe this? And we finally realized, you know, it's like Gripe Fest 2K, you know, 7 in here. And so we decided to kind of separate from each other and just pray apart from one another. And so we kind of found different places, you know, in the downstairs of my house and just got alone and just prayed for a little while. And so after, you know, praying for a little bit, we came back together and just kind of asked that question, you know, did you get anything? Like, what did you hear? Did you hear anything from the Lord? Did anything, you know, get impressed upon your heart? Like, how was that for you? And all five of us, when we came back together, the thing that God had really laid on our heart was this idea of gratitude. That he just, I mean, that it was easy. Like, we created this culture of complaining, you know? Like, it was easy to point out all the things that weren't going right in our lives when there was so much that was so good about our lives. I mean, the things we got to do and be a part of and the friendships we had and our wives and our babies, and that there was just so much that we had to be thankful for. But yet it was so easy for us to shift into that complaining mode. And so what we did is what we realized was that we needed to cultivate this habit of gratitude, of joy. So we decided that we were going to throw a big party, and we called it a Celebrate Life party. And basically, the whole idea of the Celebrate Life party is that we were going to get a bunch of our friends together, And we were just going to celebrate all that was good about life. And so one of our friends that was in that that accountability group, his uncle owns this fat houseboat up on Lake Altoona. So we're like, well, that's a great place for a party. And so we decided that we were going to go one Saturday afternoon and just spend all day on the lake with our friends. And from the time that we arrived in the church parking lot to carpool together to the time that we left to come home, that our whole focus would be on all the good things that God was doing in our lives and around us and that we were a part of. And so, you know, we had a CD that we had made for everyone to listen to on the way up. And we even had a canvas there in the boat that if people wanted to paint, you know, something that they were about, you know, symbolic or real or whatever, just something that was impressed upon them to just say thanks to God. We encouraged people to write down stories of things that they were thankful for and then share them with each other. And then the night kind of culminated with this worship set on the top deck of this boat and just people kind of sharing things that they were thankful for God about and thankful to God about and worshiping together. And it was just awesome. I mean, it really was just an amazing time. And we just said, you know, we're going to stop. And the whole focus from the time we wake up to the time we go to bed is just to praise God for all the good that he had done. We're going to celebrate life. And so every year since then, we've had our Celebrate Life party. But the point of that story is this, and this is where I'm going today, actually, is that whole journey for Keys, when he talked about a few weeks ago, he talked about this idea that we've got to discipline, you've got to practice, train ourselves for joy. That was our journey of that. You know, we're going to intentionally celebrate life and all that God has done. Well, at the end of that time together, my friend whose aunt and uncle owned this boat, who don't necessarily have a relationship with Jesus, aren't actively involved in their church. They're just, they're pursuing lots of other things, making lots of money, doing life the best that they can, but don't really have an intimate relationship with God. Well, at the end of this night, I can remember, I mean, this has marked me since that day. I remember them walking up to us with tears in their eyes and saying, if you ever want to do this again, our boat is open to you. And we're all like, yeah, you know, next Saturday. Just overwhelmed by what they had just experienced. And the people that were in this little heart, like this little cove where we were, that all of these other boats had kind of docked up alongside of us. And as the day had gone on, as we played together and just spent time together and then worshiped together, they kind of just gradually creeped in into that place and were all on the deck with us. And many of whom didn't have a relationship with Jesus that said, hey, next time you do this, you better make sure that we know about it. And it was as if they were saying, you know what, I don't really know what was going on. I don't really get it, but whatever it was, I want to be a part of that thing. And I was telling this story to Bo, who's on staff here, Bo Hooper, a good guy. And he was kind of, you know, I told him this story and then he kind of paused afterwards. And he said, you know, that's my story. He said that when I was in college, he kind of ran with a wild crowd. And they had this friend that they got to know. And for 2 years, this friend just hung out with them and was kind of in their world. But there was something different about this guy until finally Bo said he got the courage to just ask one day after 2 years to say, man, what is it that's different about you? What is it that you have that I don't have? And from that moment and from that answer, Bo's life was changed forever. And now he loves Jesus like crazy, and the way that the husband that he is and the father that he is, the man that he is, has been impacted because there was something different about this guy. And we all love those stories, you know, the stories where somebody says, you know, you probably never even noticed me, but I don't know what it is about you, but what is it in your life? And I know deep down, all of us wish that we could be those people that all of a sudden somebody would just walk up to us and say, I don't know what you have, but whatever it is, I want it. You know, I mean, I know I do, that my next door neighbor would just walk up to me and be like, hey, watch you mowing the lawn and whatever it is you've got. I need that. You mean the fact that I missed huge chunks of grass? You like that? Whatever it is you have. So what is that difference? What is it that makes us different? What is it that separates us from the rest of the world that makes the world go, you know, whatever it is you've got, I don't understand it, but I want to be a part of it. And the people in Corinth, you know, like as Buddy's been talking about the last few weeks, he's kind of been diving into the first few chapters of Corinthians. We're asking a lot of the same questions. You know, there they were, this new group of believers trying to figure out what does it mean to follow Jesus in a pagan, sensuous, you know, philosophical and just materialistic culture, which sounds a lot like us, you know. What does it look like? What's going to set us apart? And so they had all these kind of arguments going on back and forth. Well, I follow Apollos. I follow Paul. I follow Cephas. And Paul said, no, that's not at all what it's about. Well, I don't eat meat. I do eat meat. Well, no, that's not what it's about. Well, I'm really a gifted speaker. You know, I can really hear things from God and then articulate it well to other people. Or I have this capacity to see needs that people have and then meet those needs. Or I just have a really generous heart. So this is my giftedness. This is how I'm talented. This is how I'm wired. This is what sets me apart. And Paul says, no, that's not it at all. So they're all trying to figure out, what is it that's going to mark us as followers of Jesus? What's our trademark going to be? Is it going to be who we listen to? Is it going to be the minute things that we believe? Is it going to be, you know, how gifted or talented that we are? And what's interesting is that Jesus was actually asked kind of a similar question. He was, you know, there's this group of Jews that lived at the time in a very, like, incredibly oppressive culture. And a guy comes up and asks Jesus, okay, all right, I'm trying to follow God here. What is the most important thing? What is that thing going to be? What is this defining thing? Like, what is the most important commandment? What is it that's going to mark me as a follower of God? And this is what Jesus' answer. It's in Mark 12. The most important one, answered Jesus, is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. And the second is this. Love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. So when Jesus was asked, what is it that God wants from us? What is this most important thing? Well, love. That you would love. That you would love God and you would love others. And so, and Buddy's actually, that's kind of become our defining thing. You know, a few weeks ago, Buddy again talked about this whole idea of 1, 2, 3, be the church. Y'all, you remember what I'm talking about? At least not if you don't, because he gets really upset if you, 1, 2, 3, be the church. That we're to, as a body, we're to love God, love each other, and love the world. It comes out of Jesus' answer. What is it that's going to make us, that's going to mark us as followers of Jesus? But then there's this verse that's always kind of, I've never really understood. And that in John 13, Jesus is talking to his friends right before he's about to go be crucified, right before everything's about to go down. And they're having dinner together, and he's trying to just speak into them, you know, this is what you're about to experience. This is what's about to happen. This is what you can anticipate. This is who I want you to be. And what he says is this, John 13, a new command I give you, love one another. A new command I give you, love one another. But the thing I was kind of struck by is that that's not very new at all. In fact, Jesus already said that the most important thing you can do is love God and love others. So how in the world is this a new command? What's new about loving one another? And so I started looking at it, and what I realized is that there's kind of two different Greek words for new. One is the word neo, which means that something new, like something that's never been, something that is from nothing before. So, for example, like a new baby, you know. And speaking of, you know, Buddy said that Sadie and I are actually expecting a new baby, which is really a big deal, and we're very excited about. Yeah, thank you. And we actually just found out that it's a boy, so that's kind of cool, which, for those of you who don't know me, it's not that I'm like anti-girl, you know. It's just I already have two. So or, you know, even my dog is a girl. So I'm really, I was pulling, I just need one more male in my house, please. And so this is very exciting for us, a little boy in February. And actually, though, my girls really wanted another girl. And we're all in the room together when we found out, you know, we're doing the ultrasound thing. And the doctor tells us, you know, well, it's a boy. And Sadie and I are just like in tears, you know. And Eden, who's my oldest, she's 5. And she's like, eh. And she just walks off. Could you act excited a little bit? Well, and then, so the next day, Jolie, who's 3, and Jolie goes to preschool, and she tells her teacher, I'm having a baby brother. And her preschool teacher said, oh, that's great. What are you going to name him? And Jolie said, Jennifer. Yeah. And so her teacher actually said, you know, well, Jennifer's a girl's name. And Jolie goes, he's going to be a boy, Jennifer. So we wrote that down on the list. Just kidding. We're not going to name him Jennifer. There's some guys out there being like, dude, if you name that boy Jennifer. Where was I? I had nothing to do with my sermon. I just like that story. New baby. We're having a new baby. And so that's the word neo, but that's not the word that Jesus uses there. The word is kainos, which means like a new kind of thing, something that's unheard of, something fresh, something that's been before, but is being revealed in a way that no one ever saw before. He's renewing this command. Something higher, superior, of greater quality than anything that had been before. So there's something about this love that Jesus talks about that is different than anything that the world has ever seen. So what makes it new? Well, before, when God was telling his people, these are the kind of people I want you to be. This is what's going to make you different. This is what's going to set you apart, is the way that you love. Love the Lord your God. Love one another. Well, the best example we had was, well, the way we love ourselves. Love each other the way that you love yourself. And now Jesus is saying, no, there's a higher way, a new way, a more valuable way, a more powerful way. It's not that the model of love is the way you love yourself any longer. There's something even better. I am your model for love now. Love one another. And he goes on, as I have loved you, so you must love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. That we have a whole new understanding and capacity of what human love is in the person of Jesus that nobody in history has ever had before. That this understanding we had before of just, well, love your neighbor as yourself, like those passages there in Leviticus that where that verse is found, are things like, well, don't kill each other, you know? Don't sleep with your neighbor's wife. Don't steal. It's basically self-preservation. And Jesus enters into this thing that's not just anymore about, well, love them as you would love yourself, but love the way that I have loved you. And so here we are in Corinth, in Corinth, Paul writing a letter to the Corinthians. What is it that's going to set you apart? What is this going to leave your mark? What is your trademark going to be? What is this thing that makes us followers of Jesus? The world goes, I don't understand it, but whatever it is, I want to be a part of it. Now, when Jesus talked, a new command I give you, love each other the way that I have loved you. By this, all people will know that you're my disciples. And so we get this passage in 1 Corinthians where Paul says, you know, the things that you thought were going to make you different, the things that you thought were the most important things aren't the most important things at all. In fact, there in chapter 12, he's talking about spiritual gifts, these ways that God has wired each of us uniquely to serve the body, that there is no part of the body that is more or less important than any other part of the body. But after this conversation about spiritual gifts, he ends chapter 12 with this statement, but now I will show you the most excellent way. And then we get into this passage in 1 Corinthians 13. the love passage. So what is this thing called love? And those of you that are big blank filler outers, I'm obviously not because I totally forgot we even had those. That first one is that Jesus commands love. Jesus commands love. Jesus models love. And then Paul describes love. We're to love the way that Jesus loved us. Well, what does that look like? Paul starts off by saying this. The things that you thought were the most important aren't. 1 Corinthians 13:1. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels but don't love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, even if I have a faith that has the power to move mountains, but I don't love, I am nothing. If I was to give every penny that I have, everything possession-wise that is mine to the poor, and sacrifice my body to the flames, but don't love, I gain nothing. What will it be that sets us apart? Well, the way that we love. And then Paul goes on to describe this love. And what I want to do is actually want to, for us to kind of just read it out loud together, if that's cool. So we're going to throw it up there. So if you'll join me, here we go. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. And we said that Jesus commanded it, but Jesus also modeled it. And so it's just as easy for us to, I mean, if we want to know what love is like, this kind of love that Jesus says, love others the way that I have loved you. Well, we could just as easily, and we're actually going to do this, we could read this out loud. You can replace the word love there. 1 John says, God is love, with the word Jesus. I mean, this just describes who Jesus is. So let's read this out loud again, but this time with Jesus in there. You ready? Jesus is patient. Jesus is kind. Jesus does not envy. Jesus does not boast. Jesus is not proud. Jesus is not rude. Jesus is not self-seeking. Jesus is not easily angered. Jesus keeps no record of wrongs. Jesus does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. Jesus always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Jesus never fails. But the crazy thing wasn't that where Paul and where Jesus left it was, well, that's just the way Jesus is. I really want you to just understand that intellectually. But that's what we are to be. The kind of people that we are in this community. The kind of people we are in our neighborhoods. The kind of people we are in our workplaces should be the kind of people that are defined just as much by that as Jesus was. So I'm going to actually do something else, if we could. If you'll kind of just humor me a little bit. What I want to do is all of us together, is I want to take the word love out again and Jesus out. And I just want you to fill your name in the blank. So not your neighbor's name. I'll be like, Paul should be. But your name. So we're going to do this together. And so here we go. You ready? Brian is patient. Brian is kind. Brian does not envy. Brian does not boast. Brian is not proud. Brian is not rude. Brian is not self-seeking. Brian is not easily angered. Brian keeps no record of wrongs. Brian does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. Brian always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Brian never fails. Anybody else like, oh? You know, I mean, like, aren't there a few of those, at least one, maybe? Like, you go, not exactly true for me. This morning, actually, even, I'm getting ready to, you know, for church, and I got up earlier than my girls, and so I came downstairs, and I was kind of in my little office area, and I walked into the kitchen, and I walked across the kitchen and turned on the lights, and I turned on the lights, and right as I turn around, I step right into where my dog had gotten sick last night. Yeah, anybody had that experience? Anybody had that experience this morning? So if you shake my hand or hug me after church, don't lean in too close. You know what I'm saying? But my first reaction was, well, I won't tell you my first reaction. My next reaction was, you know, I bet that if I just left and turned the lights off, Sadie would just think that I didn't even see it this morning, right? You know, my first impulse wasn't like, you know, the most loving thing to do here would be to clean up Harley vomit off the kitchen floor. I mean, so there's these things that we want to be true of us, you know? We want to naturally bend towards patience and kindness and gentleness, to not be rude, to not think only about ourselves, but to think about others, to not delight in evil, but rejoice with the truth. That it would be true of me that I would always protect, always trust, always hope. But I'll be honest, there's more than one phrase in there that I, no, that's not true about me. I mean, there's some of you that really wanted to elbow your husband next to you and be like, should be. But it's what God's calling us to. So we're going to actually dive into those just a little bit here. Now, I'm not going to go, it's not like a 10-point sermon I'm going to do every one. Don't worry. I'm just going to do two and just spend some time kind of focusing. And I know that there's others that for you may have been different. That may have you been like, ah, that is not who I am, but that's who I want to be. And could we really believe that for each other too? The people we live with and do community with, that, you know what? They may not always be that way, but they really want to be, you know, that we could extend that kind of grace to each other. So maybe for you is to go home and really spend some time on some other ones. But where we're going to go is just these first two. Love is patient. Love is patient. Wow. Love is patient. There's a great book by John Ortberg called The Life You've Always Wanted. And he tells a story in there about John Ortberg's a pastor and teacher up in Chicago at Willow Creek. And he had just moved into a new role, a new position at the church, kind of moved, had all this stuff going on. I mean, life was just crazy, trying to figure out what he's supposed to be doing, you know, figuring out a new job, a new place, new people. He's trying to be a good husband and a good father. So he has all of this stuff going on. So he decides to call his spiritual mentor, who lives across the country. And this was free long distance with cell phones. So he's making a long distance call. It's kind of a big deal to call his spiritual mentor and just get some advice. So to just ask him, you know, what do I need to be spiritually healthy? What do I need to be spiritually healthy? So he has his pen ready, you know, he's ready to go to write this down. And this is what his mentor answers. You must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. You must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. So John is like, man, that's good. That's good. Okay, what else? And his mentor pauses and he says, that's it. And he's wanting to glean as much, you know, I just paid for this long distance phone call. I'm going to glean as many spiritual nuggets of wisdom as I can in this moment right now. That's it. You must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. Is what he writes, that hurry is the great enemy of spiritual life in our day. Hurry can destroy our souls. Hurry can keep us from living well. For many of us, the great danger is not that we will renounce our faith. It is that we will become so distracted and rushed and preoccupied that we will settle for a mediocre version of it. We will just skim over our lives instead of actually living them. Following Jesus cannot be done at a sprint. If we want to follow someone, we can't go faster than the one who is leading. It says that love and hurry are incompatible. Love takes time. And the one thing that busy people don't have is time. And it's not that Jesus wasn't busy. That, in other words, that his life wasn't full. I mean, he was trying to change the world in 3 years, you know. Had quite a mission in front of him. There's always something going on. But over and over again, we see Jesus stopping and stepping back and getting alone. Getting alone with his Father. Getting alone with his closest friends. Even the most like critical moments of his ministry, when they're wanting to make him king, that he says, come away with me and get some rest. Jesus, sure, he was busy. Sure, his life was full, but he was never hurried. That he always had time for the people that were around him. Are we leaving enough margin in our life that we can even love? I mean, we want to be people that love. And if love is going to be the thing that that defines us as a church, that transforms this community, that we won't be defined by love if we are defined by busyness. I mean, to be really honest, even if that's for no one else in the room, I mean, that's me. I mean, I get home and I have meetings all day long, and I walk in the door and my girls run to hug me. But honestly, I'm just tired and I'd rather just sit down. And Sadie wants to tell me about the things that are going on in her life that God is teaching her. And to be honest, I'm tired of listening to people tell me about what God is teaching them. I mean, it's terrible to say out loud here in front of 1,000 people, but it's true. I mean, I so fill my day and I just move through it so fast that the ones that are the most important to me have nothing but leftovers. And I'm so trying to get from one point to the other to get as much as I can cram into my day as possible that I miss the people that are right around me. Love and hurry are fundamentally incompatible. In fact, this past Thursday and Friday, there's an event called Catalyst. And Catalyst is 13,000 pastors and church leaders from all over the world that come together at Gwinnett Arena and have different speakers and people come in. And actually, it was kind of cool because Keys had the opportunity to lead worship for the Thursday night session. And what was amazing about it is that we had, you know, all day long, I mean, speaker after speaker, just studs, you know, like just killing it. You know, everything they say, you can't write fast enough, you know. But for that last one, they just said, you know what, we just want to stop. And as leaders, we feel like we got to make the most of every moment, you know. All these 13,000 pastors, they got to get 48 hours worth of good material to go home and teach people, you know. But we just stopped, and Keys just led us in this just... We're just going to love God for a little bit. We're not going to learn anything else. We're just going to be present in this moment. And it was probably the most powerful moment of that entire weekend. Friday night, there's some friends that we've met that actually live in the Bahamas. And Keith met them a few years ago at Catalyst. And so they were back again this year. And just a great family. And we got to have dinner together there Friday night. And... I'm sitting there talking. His name's Chris. Chris is a youth pastor in Abaco, Bahamas. You know, like if I was to tell you right now, hey, I've got a helicopter outside for you on the way to the Bahamas. I mean, I guarantee almost every one of us would be like, all right, I'm done. See ya. You know, the Bahamas is paradise. And Chris is standing there and he says, man, I'll be honest. Coming to Snowville has been so refreshing. Wait, what? Snellville, Georgia. Do you realize where you are? The nearest beach is several hundred miles away. The closest thing we have to mountains is that giant granite sculpture, you know? This is refreshing. But even in what we would consider paradise, it just said, I was just missing my wife. We're just so busy. We didn't have time for each other. I was just missing the Lord. I wasn't making time for him. So he comes to Snellville, and God does something to restore his soul. That really has nothing to do with where you are. It has everything to do with who you are. So love is patient. Love takes time. And then that next one. Love is kind. And to be really honest, I kind of skim over that one. Because it sounds kind of wimpy, you know? Love is kind, you know, like zippity-doo-dah, you know? Go be kind to each other, you know? And maybe that's just me. Wish I hadn't admitted that. I'll tell you another story from the 9 o'clock. I was thinking about that, and I started to say, let's all go get a tattoo of love is kind. And the image in my head, and I was trying to describe because it kind of came out before I could even process what I was thinking. And the image in my head was of getting a big old tattoo of like a yellow smiley face, you know, like how cheesy that would be. And I'm standing out there after the service. And this dude walks up who is a lot bigger than I am. I mean, just kind of a jacked guy. You know, if he told you that, like, he ate people for a living, I would believe him. And he goes, hey, I just want to show you something. And right here on his forearm is a big yellow smiley face. And I was like, did I say cheesy? I meant awesome. He was nice about it. but the word there for kind, love is kind, there's a Greek word agathos, and that would be like our word nice, like love is nice. Just let's go all be nice to each other. You know, don't rock the boat, don't ruffle any feathers, just go be nice to each other. We should all be really nice people. That's not the word that's used. Like that word agathos means like good or agreeable, happy. But the word there is this word krestoumai, which... it comes from this word cresto, which means fit for use, useful, to take into service. So it actually probably be better translated, love pursues kindness. It's a real active phrase. Love is intentional about pursuing the good for somebody else. Love is intentional about going after service. In fact, is that word there in Romans 2:4? Or do you show contempt for the riches of his kindness, tolerance, and patience, not realizing that God's kindness leads you towards repentance? It's not God's niceness, how nice God is, but how actively he has been pursuing you that you would know how crazy in love with you he is. And so there's kind of two sides to that idea of actively pursuing kindness. Love pursues kindness. And one is this idea of hospitality, which Buddy talked about a few weeks ago. You know, 1 Peter 4:9, offer hospitality to one another. That we would be the kind of people that open our lives, open our hearts, open our homes to one another. And honestly, there's a lot of people I think that after they hear that idea, they want to be hospitable. They want to have, you know, come, you know, do life with us. But there's this kind of fear that... They think that their home has to be spotless to have people over, you know? Or mine. Or that the meal has to be perfectly delicious. But the point isn't how clean your house is or how great of a cook you are. The point is that you spend time together. Everything doesn't have to be perfect. In fact, you just order a pizza, you know? Throw some hot dogs in the microwave. That's what we do. Or make a sandwich. I mean, what's important is that unhurried, going back to love takes time, that we create space to just be together. So honestly, for some of us, you know, maybe going from here, what we need to do is figure out, how do I create more margin in my life? What do I need to say no to? How do I create time? I mean, we're all given the same amount of time. What are we doing with it? No one's forcing you to do all the things that you're doing. But maybe for some of you, it's just... you know, just look at the person next to you. And don't actually do that now, because if you make eye contact, it could be really awkward. But look at it and just have them over. Just go do lunch together. Invite your next door neighbor over. Just go spend time with people. Open your life, open your hearts, open your homes to the people around you. And it doesn't matter that you don't have it all together, because guaranteed, you know what? They don't have it all together either. There's a couple here at Grace that so defines that for me and Sadie. And many of you probably already know them. It's Mike Williams is the chairman of the board here. And he and Pam, I mean, you just don't know who's going to be at their house anytime you go by. And in fact, anytime you go by, you're just as likely to be invited to just, you know, here's a chocolate chip cookie. Stay for dinner. You know, I mean, they're just those kind of people. So I'm inviting all 1,000 of you over to Mike and Pam's house after after church. We'll do lunch together. Just kidding. But they've opened their home. They've made a decision. They're going to be the kind of family that just invites people in. Sadie had the opportunity to live with them for a few months while we were engaged. And just watched over and over again as their home became other people's homes. And I know there's a lot of you that are that same way. Buddy and Jody that always have people living in their basement. In fact, I lived there for 2 years before I got married. After marriage, I decided it probably wasn't best for us to live in their basement still. But before that, it was awesome. But there's many of you that are that way. But for some of us, we just need to get over ourselves enough to say, hey, I don't have it all together, but I'm going to open my home to others. In fact, this is what really defined a lot of the early church. I mean, it says, Acts 2:46, they broke bread in their homes together. They ate together with glad and sincere hearts. So that was a defining thing for them. They just spent time together. They shared meals together. They did life together. And even if it's just you and one other couple that you know, just get together and love each other. And the other side of that, one is, you know, practice hospitality. But this other side of pursue kindness is this idea of intentional engagement. There's a great quote. I don't know if we have it up there, but it says, the ship is safest when it is in port. But that's not what ships were made for. How many of y'all are Lord of the Rings fans? Any Lord of the Rings fans out there? A handful of you. Well, basically, Lord of the Rings is the story of this kind of ragtag group of creatures that, you know, get sent on this incredible mission. And, you know, it kind of goes through. And they're really just an unlikely group of heroes. I mean, everyone knows that elves and dwarves don't get along. I mean, duh. That's just kind of... And yet there's an elf and a dwarf. And I know the humans in there kind of fight against each other at the beginning. Their kingdoms are divided and they're all about themselves. But the amazing thing isn't just the story of this mission. And the hero is this hobbit, you know, like the hero, this warrior figure is a hobbit who's this like short little guy who, I mean, lives in the Shire that there's probably not been a battle around in generations. I mean, this task that they're on would be more fit for like kings and knights, and it's entrusted to this nobody. And so it's an incredible story as it progresses of them moving into this adventure. But what's really even more amazing isn't just them accomplishing this task before them, but it's what happens to them as they move in this adventure together. That there's something about this as they face danger, as they put their lives on the line, as they risk, as they experience fear and uncertainty that binds them together like nothing else possibly could. To give a more real life example, have you seen the movie Finding Nemo? Anyone? More real life. Finding Nemo? More of you responded to that than Lord of the Rings, which is really sad. But Finding Nemo, basically, you know, it's this journey of this dad as he goes to, you know, find his son. And this dad at the beginning of the movie that is consumed with his son's safety. That's like number one priority is his son's safety. And so he goes out on this adventure with Dory to go find his son. But what he doesn't realize is the truth is that his son is in the safest place he probably could be. He's in an aquarium. You know, they add some drama with, you know, the dentist's daughter shaking the bag, you know. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Yeah, okay. And so, but you know, the truth is that for a fish, an aquarium doesn't get much safer. I mean, you've got clean water, you've got food coming. But there's this thing that happens to fish in aquarium is that as time progresses, they get more and more and more fragile. That if there's any change to their environment, they're likely to die. Any of you that have had an aquarium know that. That there's something about safety that makes them weaker. And so if we're to be this body that the world looks at and goes, what is it that's different? It would be easy for us to stay safe in our little aquarium of relationships and not to push out to people that we don't know. For the church, without any real engagement with the outside world, we can quickly become a sheltered, artificial environment. And though we feel safer apart from culture or apart from the scary things that are out there, that the reality is that we become more and more and more fragile, that any outside disturbance has the power to feel like it's going to kill us. And then there's something that happens when we step out into risk, when we go into those scary places, when we push each other to do things and experience things that we never would have before. When we go to downtown Atlanta, or we go on a mission trip, or we just go across the street to that jerk neighbor, you know? When we risk together, that it brings us into a community that we otherwise could not have ever imagined when we stayed safe. There's another series, it's called Band of Brothers, if there's any Band of Brothers fans. Band of Brothers is the story of this group of guys and their journey from D-Day through storming, I forgot the name of it, Hitler's headquarters. This group of guys that stayed together. And there's this scene in Band of Brothers where these guys that have been on the front line for months fighting together. And it kind of shows this progression that they're moving back to, you know, behind the lines to get some, you know, to kind of get, you know, recharged and to get supplies. And what they find is they move farther and farther away from those front lines, that they begin to experience and begin to witness more and more infighting and more politics and more issues and more complaining. That there's something that as they disengage and as they surround themselves with people that are disengaged from those front lines, that people become more and more self-consumed, comfortable, and safe doesn't necessarily equal life. Buddy says this a lot. Are we going to be a fortress or are we going to be a force? That for a living system, moving towards stability and equilibrium actually means moving closer to death. So the phrase, love is kind, is actually one of the most dangerous phrases in the Bible. What would it look like if in our workplaces, in our neighborhoods, in this city, we really were a people, and so many of you are, that we became those people that pursued kindness? So Jesus commands it, Jesus models it, and then lastly, and this is what I want to end with, Jesus empowers it. 1 John 4:19, we love because he first loved us. So he's our example, but he's also our enabler. That we're really not able to love this way on our own, in our own power. We can't work it up in ourselves. That really it's only as we receive the love of Jesus that we're able to demonstrate the love of God. When Buddy was talking about that 1, 2, 3, love God, love each other, reach the world, the thing that he encouraged us, and if you haven't done this yet, then I would also encourage you to do this, was for that love each other piece, to study the one another commands in the Bible. So just go online to, you know, studylight.org or Blue Letter Bible or one of those online references and just type in one another and study those verses in the New Testament about who we are to be, that one another. But the amazing thing is, I was looking at that, is that so many of those one another commands are rooted first in what God has already done for us. So we're told, forgive each other just as you have been forgiven. Welcome one another. Accept one another because you have been accepted. Even with all your blemishes and faults and imperfections and mistakes, accept one another just as Christ accepted you. Because you are free, serve one another. That really won't be until we become the kind of people that understand the nature and the character of God's love for us, that we will become the kind of people that love others with that same kind of love. So people ask, what's the difference? What's the difference? What is it going to be that we'll be the kind of people in Snellville, Georgia? The people say, I don't know what it is, but whatever it is, I want to be a part of it. I don't get it, but I want to be in it. Is that we would love. And we would love because we grasp how passionately, how crazy God's love for us is. That I don't have to manipulate you or use you to get something from you or to get you to do what I want you to do, because I have already received all that I need in Jesus. I don't have to hold anything against you and hope that you repay me for it, because I've already been released and forgiven in Christ. I don't need you to respond to me in any way, affirm me in any way, because I have already been fully affirmed as a son of God. How great is the love the Father has lavished on us because we are children of God. You need nothing from each other because you've already received it all in Jesus. You can forgive because you have been forgiven. You can receive because you have been accepted. You can open up your heart and your home with all of your imperfections, with all of your mistakes, with all of the things that you wish people couldn't see, because Jesus has already loved you fully. He knows you intimately, every detail of your life, every mistake you've made, every thought you've had. He knows it and he loves you. And when we stand in that kind of love, when we realize that I don't need you to fill some space in here, I don't need you to change to meet some desire that I have, then we really can learn to love. And then we can be the kind of people that Jesus has called us to be. Paul ends that 1 Corinthians passage. And he says this: love never fails. Love never fails. Love never fails. Love wins. And now these three remain: faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. Make love your aim. Let's pray. Father, I pray, God, for me, as well as for every life in this room, every story that is represented in this room, that we really would be the kind of people that just allow you to love on us. You would fill our broken places. You would heal our hurts. And that it is in experiencing your love for us that we would really be able to love and to engage others. That we would create that space in our life where we can just love the people around us. Where we'd open up our hearts and our homes. We would intentionally pursue those that desperately need you. And that we as a body would be those people that the stories are told of us over and over again. I don't know what's going on over there, but whatever it is, I want to be a part of it. God, please let that be true of me in North Fork, in Snellville. I pray that would be true of every person in this room. And it's in your name, by your blood and your power, we pray. Amen.